Okay, you're welcome back to the 9 till Noon Show. A very good morning if you're just after joining us. And a big welcome to the hundreds of you watching the show as well. Just to remind you, you can do so on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland, on your smart TV, your Fire Stick tablet or phone, and also across our Facebook pages, Anita, Bernadette, Marie O'Donnell and Paul. Good morning to you all as well. Thanks for the kind wishes. Later on, we're in the garden. Paul's going to be in studio with us answering your gardening questions. And as I say, that also applies to those of you who maybe don't have a garden. You've got an indoor space, you want a potted plant or whatever it might be. Maybe it's something you want to grow indoors. All your questions answered to 08660 25000. We're going to be speaking to the Polish ambassador very shortly, off the back of their visit to this part of the world. That and so much more besides. A couple of comments before we head towards the bingo numbers. Good luck to Bunkrana Medical Centre, who are holding a coffee morning this morning. It's for Relay for Life and it runs until 1 o'clock. I was kind of wondering, Greg, why they bother having elections in the north when Stormont is still shut down. What's the point? Well, it's council elections, you see. So the councils, I believe, and I'm open to correction on this, the councils in Northern Ireland perhaps have more influence or input in terms of, you know, bin collection, the running of leisure facilities and what have you. So they're electing along those lines. And dependent on how the DUP, Sinn Féin and others do, it could influence whether or not Stormont is brought back up into power as well. So, I mean, if you're into politics and you think voting matters, I suppose they are relatively important. It's the same as our council elections in the Republic versus the Dáil elections when they come around. Greg, teachers should not be allowed to use phones in classrooms for role modelling, safety and privacy of students. Now, I'm not, it's a long time since I was in school, as you can imagine. I'm not really quite sure how frequent teachers might use their phones in class. Has the sports desk covered the election last night of the new Donegal International Rally Committee? Well, apparently Highland Radio Sport are awaiting an official press release on this. It was the AGM of Donegal Club, which is separate to the Donegal International Rally. So as soon as we get the formal information, it will, of course, be covered. Good morning, Greg. Going forward has to be the worst for me. This is in terms of phrases that drive us up the wall, or the repetitive use of words. We were reading about it a little earlier on in the programme. So going forward really gets this person's goat. Politicians use it and you just know it means they're not going to advance one bit on what they're talking about. What's wrong with using the more honest term in the future? Okay, I get you. The phrase I hate is from the get-go. I haven't heard you say it for a while. Okay, well, I'm probably going to say it now by accident. This isn't about me, by the way. Going forward is another one that gets on people's nerves. Not see it from my house. Okay, it's another one. I agree, Greg, with all due respect, means insult is coming. I'd prefer you just insulted me without the introduction. Yeah, indeed. I'll get you a wee menu. Wee anything in a sentence does it for me. I have found myself doing the wee thing lately. It is something I wouldn't say annoyed me, but I tried to resist. But now it is the wee thing and the wee that and the wee the other. And we were in Belfast recently with, not last year or something, with someone, and they were using the wee this and the wee that. And I think it's a politeness thing. In other words, I'm sorry to put you out, but can I have a wee menu? Do you know that sort of a way? But the lady who was serving us in Belfast, I don't think that she'd come across it before and couldn't understand why every second word was wee. But anyway, Greg, about when the waitress says, yes, dear, always makes me feel old. I remember back in my days in Northwest Radio, and it is a long time ago, scary how long ago it was, is that this came up as a discussion point. And a person, an older person it was, came on and they did not like that form familiarity. Yes, dear, how are you, dear, today? Along those lines. And I think it was an older person, if my memory serves me correctly. And then we had then there was a waitress that came on who uses that, and it was a term of endearment. And so, in other words, this isn't a new thing. Does that annoy you when people maybe, is it over familiar? Yes, dear. I think that's nice. It wouldn't bother me. But then again, if you feel that it's because of your age or your gender or something, it might be offensive. But I've never had a problem with that. What do you think? Get involved in that too. As I say, we talk about the serious stuff, but we can have a bit of fun as well with it. 086 60 25000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. Right, it's jackpot day today, so I'm sure many of you out there with your bingo books open at the ready. Hopefully one of you wins big today. Don't forget the fantastic daily cash prizes that are there all the while as well. Okay, this week we've been talking about food poverty, and there are hundreds of families in Donegal alone that require regular support in order to put food on their table. Margaret joins us on this issue. Good morning, Margaret.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing good. And you're making the connection, aren't you, between the amount of food that's dumped by retailers whilst we have this food crisis?
Well, you know, often at night, like I'd be in late, I'm in one night and I said to the employee, is that food going to be dumped? And he said, yes. Well, I couldn't believe it, you know, the amount of food. Like, okay, there was a lot of meat and bread and that in it. But I feel that there should be a way around this, whereby rather than dumping it, you know, the cost of it and the price of it, and you know, to see this happening and half the world dying of hunger, and even like as you say in our own country, people, you know, needing this food, that I can't understand why, you know, there isn't some kind of a method or something in place whereby, you know, good use could be made of it. And I suppose it's not the supermarket's fault, because, you know, they would be penalised maybe darkly if they sold something that was out of date. But I think that, you know, rather than waste, especially in the current climate.
Yeah, and I imagine those businesses too factor in a certain amount of waste into their profits. You know what I mean? I would imagine they would have to have, and maybe someone in the industry might help us out, Margaret, that they say, right, well, 8% of this food is going to waste, right? So we have to factor that in to make sure that it doesn't eat into our profits. But there has to be a way, doesn't there, Margaret, in 2023 that we can bypass maybe whatever problems there are to get that food to people that need it. Now, I think we're talking about fresh food here, Margaret, aren't we? But there has to be a way.
I know that. But if you think on every trolley food of dumped waste that's from every supermarket in the country, what mountain of the mountain range of Hergill wouldn't hold it?
Yeah, and I've noticed myself too when I'm, and in fact, I noticed it yesterday when doing the big shop, Margaret. The stuff brought to the front, you know, everyone I think digs into the back now to try and get an extra 2 or 3 days out of whatever they're buying. But the stuff to the front, the stuff to the front was going out of date the next day. And I know it's a busy shop I was in, but there's no way they were going to sell all of that stuff. So it was inevitable a lot of this fresh produce that had been brought forward was not going to be shifted by the next day, and there is absolutely no way they could keep it on their shelves past due date either. Well, so it was going to go into a skip or a bin or something.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder if there was just maybe a short advertisement to say that at a particular time in a particular shop that there might be some food. But then again, I think it's the insurance issue is a big issue too. So, you know,
and we might all wait till the last minute, Margaret. So maybe they would have to do it through the likes of a food bank so it didn't become a...
I suppose that's...
And us as individuals as well. I was reading up on this after our last conversation. We ourselves, the average household apparently throws out €60 per month of food. That's our food weight. €700 per house per year. So we throw collectively, and I don't want to bamboozle people with figures, we as a population ourselves, separate from the shops, throw out €1.29 billion worth of food. That is the food waste in this country every year. Again, that would perhaps meet the needs of an awful lot of the people that we're talking about. You know, we're not going to obviously... It's when you overbuy stuff or the meat goes out of date and you don't realise, okay. But we could all be doing our bit if we could, hopefully, in some way, that food could find its way to those that need it, if that makes sense, Margaret.
Yeah, yeah. My campaign for that, maybe over the recycling business might help.
But as you say, I think it's really interesting that you saw firsthand from that person that they that food was going to go into the bin. Margaret, it's been lovely speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome. Okay, thank you.
Have a lovely day, Margaret. Have a lovely day. Margaret there thinking on her fellow person there. Anna Sochanska is the Polish ambassador to Ireland, and she joins us on the programme now. Anna, you're very welcome to Highland Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to have you with us. And we will have you in Donegal tomorrow, because you are about to undertake your first visit to the to Donegal tomorrow. You're very welcome.
Yes, Greg, and I'm very excited. I have never been to Donegal before, and I heard about the beauty of this part of Ireland. That is why I'm so excited and so happy.
Okay. Will you have an opportunity to meet Polish nationals or people originally from Poland whilst you're here? And what is your function in that regard?
Of course, wherever I travel to different places in Ireland, I always try to meet up with the Polish people, and this will be, of course, a good opportunity to meet them, because as far as I know, none of my predecessors visited Polish school in Letterkenny, so I will have this opportunity to meet them and to hear about their opinions about the functioning of the Polish school, about their life in Ireland. It's always a great pleasure to talk to them and to exchange the views on Polish-Irish relations as well, because of course, relations with the Polish diaspora is mainly the responsibility of consuls, but as the ambassador, of course, I focus on the relations between Poland and Ireland. But for me, it's a great pleasure also to meet with the Polish diaspora. As you know, there are 120,000 Polish people living in Ireland. So it would be strange if the Polish ambassador wouldn't be interested in meeting them.
Yes, and many of that you will meet, particularly the younger people, will be second, third generation. A lot of their parents, or indeed maybe in some cases grandparents, have been living here for a very long time now.
Absolutely. I think the main wave of the migration of people from Poland to Ireland happened in 2004 when Poland joined the European Union. And as you may know, Ireland was one of three EU countries that opened their labor markets immediately. So people just decided to go to Ireland, and they loved it from the very beginning. You know, there is a kind of a proximity and a kind of similar mentality between the Polish and Irish people. And I think that Polish people are doing great here in Ireland. They feel at home. At the same time, what is really great thing, and I respect them for that, they still want to keep in touch with their families, friends, and they are so much well organized around the system of Polish weekend schools, and they care about their children to know the Polish language and to know the Polish history. So this is wonderful that at the same time you can be part of two kind of societies. You can love both countries, Poland and Ireland.
The country, the people you talk of in the mid noughties, they left a country perhaps that's somewhat different to the country now. And I think particularly with the events of the last couple of years, the political situation, the proximity to Ukraine, and the greatly increased population of Poland. Presumably, it's very much on the minds of Polish people in Ireland as well as those still living in Poland.
Of course, when they left Poland in 2004, it was just the beginning of the transformation of our country. So those people were looking for better opportunities. There was not so much so many jobs in Poland. But as you celebrate now 50th anniversary of your membership of the European Union, and Poland is your kind of your younger brother or younger sister. We will celebrate 20th anniversary next year, but one have to really admit that as Ireland, Poland also benefited so much out of the EU membership. And now, if you went to Poland, you would see a different country, well organized, with very entrepreneurial people, beautiful. So I encourage our listeners to visit Poland. Of course, now the situation is very difficult because of the war started by Russia in Ukraine, and we focus so much on our assistance for the Ukrainians. In total, we would have like 3 million Ukrainian people in Poland, including 1.5 million of recent refugees. So it's a huge burden on our economy. But at the same time, I think the Polish society and the Polish government and local government and NGOs, they passed this exam very well.
Mm-hmm. That's a huge influx of people in short term, and every country is facing the same issues at the moment. And also, too, every country is dealing with perhaps an increase in nationalism as well. I presume it's the same in Poland as it is right across Europe, and that has to be managed and debated and discussed as well.
Well, nationalism is a very bad word, I would say, and sometimes people misuse this. Of course, there, anywhere else in Europe, there are people who are against migration or who would rather focus on their own interests. I think that the war in Ukraine showed us that Europe is a good place, is a place where people really care about their neighbors, whether these are neighbors, you know, on the other side of the street, or neighbors, you know, like, you know, in case of Poland, Ukraine. We really proved as the Europeans fantastic solidarity and support for people in need. And I think the people who are against such activities should really not kind of overshadow what good has been done in Europe so far.
Okay, now there is also a theme to your visit as well, and that would be the fact that Milford in Donegal is hosting the National Famine Commemoration, and we're going to talk now about an exhibition and a conversation you'll be having at Kerry Keele National School, because there is a connection between the famine and a Polish nobleman. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, thank you very much for asking me this question, because it's very important from my perspective and my colleagues at the Polish embassy. Actually, this exhibition is our project, because of course not many people know that there is this link between Poland and Ireland, as Paul Strzelecki, in Polish Paweł Strzelecki, who was a Polish nobleman and a humanitarian, who was the agent of British Relief Association, and he volunteered to come to Ireland. And he was absolutely fantastic person, and he introduced, I would say, a very modern way of helping people, especially children, through the system of local schools. He fed them through the system of local schools, and it is estimated that he might have saved like 200,000 Irish children from starving. Otherwise, they would have perished and died during this tragic time. So our embassy, my predecessor was the initiator of this beautiful exhibition about Paul Strzelecki. This is the, I would say, traveling exhibition. It travels all over Ireland. And we also finance special workshops for Irish pupils in different places, just to tell them about this beautiful story of Polish-Irish relations. Mm-hmm. And you know, for me, it's a double pleasure, because I'm coming to Milford Library to meet the students and also local politicians and Milford librarian to talk about Strzelecki. But at the same time, on Sunday, I will be taking part in national commemoration of the Great Famine. Mm-hmm. So I'm very proud that Poland, a Polish person, played a very important role in this tragic period for the Irish people.
Yes, and it's great that you and your predecessor recognise this. Just interested to know, is Paul Zaleski's contribution recognised in Ireland? Is there anything to commemorate him in this country, or to recognise it, or is that work being done through your good offices?
Yes, we try to do more. Of course, exhibition and workshop, this is one thing. We unveiled a plaque dedicated to Strzelecki, but I would also like to have a monument of Strzelecki. We started our conversations with some local authorities, and I hope it will happen soon. But of course, the most fantastic thing would be just to have an exhibition in one of the Irish museums, and maybe something in in the Irish curriculum in a history book, just the information that there was such a man from Poland.
Yeah, for sure. It's a remarkable story and one we might look at into the future ourselves. For now, Anna, thank you very much indeed. Again, we look forward to hosting you in Donegal, and enjoy your weekend. Thank you so much indeed. That is Anna Sowanska, who is the Polish ambassador to Ireland. Now, data collected from coroners around Ireland shows that there are 44 records of unidentified remains with DNA profiles for 28 unidentified remains recorded on the National DNA database. Details relating to the remains have been published on a new database, which is the first of its kind in Ireland. Pat O'Connor is of the Coroners Society of Ireland, and I'm pleased to welcome him onto the programme now. Pat, thank you very much for joining us.
Not at all, Greg. Good morning to you and to all the Highland listeners this morning.
Right. Talk to us about the background to the establishment of this database and what kind of an undertaking it was.
Okay. Just my own position is that I'm the public information officer for the Coroner Society of Ireland, whom there are 34 coroners in the country. I'm also the coroner for the District of Mayo, and I'm sitting in that regard. So on Tuesday last, there was a launch of the actual database itself. But by way of background, I think it's important to perhaps let your listeners know that the establishment of the National DNA database in 2015 by Forensic Science Ireland was a key turning point in the identification of human remains in Ireland. And it's from that this particular database has grown. In fact, I think the department and the government introduced 10 years ago a National Missing Persons Day in all Ireland to annually commemorate the day and the events of people passing away. So what happened last Tuesday in Dublin when the database was launched was that in 2021, the Department of Justice, along with the Garda Síochána Missing Persons Unit, and Forensic Science Ireland decided that they would try and exchange information on unidentified remains in the country. And it was intended that the data set up would be updated every year. So it's not sort of a static sort of database. And if there are any changes to be made to it, which hopefully there won't be too many going forward, it can be done. As you've identified in your opening there, there were 44 records of unidentified remains in Ireland identified. I think there was two in Donegal. There's one actually so still outstanding. Of those, 29 are full human remains, and there are 15, unfortunately, which are partial remains. But of the 44, 28 have had DNA taken from them, and there's another 16 which will be done in due course when eventually it's up and running and people wish to sort of identify them.
And I see a map produced here, and I'm not sure if it's from yourselves or a media organisation, but it talks about when the remains were discovered, but that of course doesn't tell us when a person may have passed away or when the remains were located there, does it necessarily?
No, it doesn't indeed. It's purely to identify where the unidentified remains are at present.
And we are a small country and a coastal country as well, so there is obviously an opportunity that people have come into the country and sadly passed away, maybe wanting to disappear from another, or they've moved around Ireland, or they were lost at sea and found on the shore. So I think it's important that it's a countrywide database, because of course the remains found in Donegal could be that of a person from Wexford, for an example.
Absolutely, or they could be from a fishing vessel or from a boat at sea. You know, there is no way of identifying clearly. Unidentified is what it says. Yes. Regretfully, and if you look at the concentration of where the unidentified persons are presently located in burial grounds, and most of them are on the east coast, and that's, I suppose, consistent with, first of all, population, but also with the ebb and flow of tides across the Irish Sea from Wales to and England across to Ireland, and vice versa. And increasingly, I suppose, as Ireland becomes a multicultural society, there are going to be persons who are in the country and who pass away and sadly pass away, and they have no identity, or they cannot be identified, and that causes issues as well, of course.
The DNA database that we have of the 28, does that tell us anything of someone's background or where they may originally from, or is it literally their identifying markers that can be checked against another sample?
That's correct, Greg. That it's an identifying marker. It doesn't tell you anything about where they're from, what they are. It's possible to identify whether it's male or female, and perhaps give an approximate age, but it doesn't go any further than that. If it could, it would be great, but unfortunately that's not the situation in medical science. But it has developed dramatically, it hasn't developed to that extent. And I suppose really, at the end of the day, until such time as everybody's DNA is on some sort of an ID card, right throughout Europe, and dare say the world, but particularly in Europe, that's not going to be of tremendous assistance.
Now, of course, this is very important and very well-intentioned because, you know, I mean, this could solve mysteries out there. People could have the remains of their loved ones returned, but there are 856 unsolved missing persons. So that's potentially 856, I would argue, probably very many more who might think, well, one of those could be the person, you know, one of those could be my loved one who is missing. So do you expect this will trigger a rush of people looking to offer samples to Forensic Science Ireland? Because I don't think I could settle until such time as I gave my DNA to see if any of these identified or unidentified remains, are those of someone close to me that's missing. Do you get so there's a lot to work through here, I imagine.
Oh yes, there is indeed, and you've hit literally the point, to the important point. I mean, the fact that there's 840 people missing doesn't mean that they're deceased. Yeah. And even if they are, they may not be in Ireland. But it is a starting point. But I would say that if anyone has any suspicion or indeed any inkling that one of these people who are unidentified, who are buried in Ireland, might be one of their loved ones, the important thing would be to make contact with the Garda Síochána Missing Persons Unit. There's a telephone number for that, which is on the coroner's website, which is www.coroners.ie. But the phone number for anyone who wishes to start the process that you've just identified is 01-666-9476. And I think I would encourage people, it's a matter for everyone themselves, but I would encourage people that if they have the slightest inkling at all, to contact the Garda Síochána. They will be asked, are they prepared to give a sample of their own DNA so that then a test can be run on the national database to see whether or not there is any match between the unidentified people who are buried and themselves.
And of course, we are a very mobile population, as are other countries now. So I presume there'll be some interest in this from people, you know, in Britain or Europe.
Well, absolutely, indeed. And I mean, they have their own databases. And clearly, if there are people from Great Britain or indeed from Europe, and increasingly Ireland is a world sort of repository of different nationalities. Yes, it will. And I think increasingly it will become very, very important for them. And while we can't speak to them from here, though I'm sure some of them do listen to Highland Radio across the water, I would encourage them to contact Garda Síochána at that number that I gave, which is 01-666-9476.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not just a case now that people are hearing this information and might be motivated to sort of say, right, I'm going to do something. We do know there have been many families and individuals who've been calling for this type of a database to be established. And here we are. And as you say, it's not static. I presume tests on the remaining 16 unidentified remains will be done shortly, and it will be continued to be added to. And hopefully it can connect people, missing people from those that are missing. And try and avoid the word closure, but at least they might have remains that they can bury and what have you. Okay, Pat, unless there's anything... Yeah, go ahead.
Just the last thing, that I mean, people grieve in different ways, but it is very difficult grieving when you don't have the actual body of the person. And if this in itself even helps a handful of people to actually bring some sort of finality to their search and then let them get on with their grieving. It won't relieve their grieving, but at least will give them some sort of certainty.
Exactly. Incredibly valuable in that regard. Thank you very much indeed. Pat O'Connor of the Coroner's Society of Ireland. There were one set of remains located. Well, there's two actually, but only one made this release, the second to be identified, the DNA to be identified. One remains located, discovered in 2021. In Leitrim, one remains located, discovered in 1986. In Sligo, remains located in 2009. And the furthest back they go is 1968. Remains were located in Wexford. Six remains located there. But the database has been put together. Currently, there are 28 set of remains already on the National DNA Database. And they say the 16 unidentified remains are to be attained where possible. And you're encouraged to contact Forensic Science Ireland to provide DNA samples to help solve these cases and provide answers, really, I presume. Now, two separate investigations are underway into an attack on a teenager in County Meath. The victim suffered facial injuries in the incident in Navan this week, which is now the subject of a Garda investigation, while the Louth Meath Education and Training Board is also investigating the incident, as some of those involved were wearing their school uniforms. Officers are asking people to stop sharing footage of the attack online, and I referenced this a little earlier on today. Professor James O'Higgins-Norman is UNESCO Chair on Bullying and Cyberbullying and is Director of DCU Anti-Bullying Centre. Thanks for joining us, Professor. It's good to have you on the programme.
Good morning.
First, let's talk about the video sharing. I think some people are outraged at this and they think they're doing the right thing in sharing it. Others share it because, you know, they're desensitized this type of stuff. I mean, there's different camps out there, but it seems the even if it's well-intentioned, it seems that Gardaí, and I'm sure you are of the opinion, that we need to stop the sharing of this video because it feels to me like another assault on this young person.
Yeah, I think your feelings are correct. You know, in usually in an act of aggression or violence or bullying, there's a somebody who engages in the bullying behavior. There's somebody who is a target, and then there are bystanders who, through their silence, effectively support the behavior. And what's happening by sharing this video online, we're amplifying that role of the bystanders from whatever number of people are actually physically there on the day to, I believe, now over 5 million people have viewed that. And the trauma that's involved for the individual involved is amplified because of that. And then also there is an effect on those who are bystanders and who watch it and, you know, become desensitized to this type of material. So I think sharing this is not a good idea at all.
Yeah, because there's different words for it. Gore videos, wrecked videos, R-E-K-T, whatever it might be. There are platforms that share these types of videos for entertainment. And it's worrying because if a younger person does get desensitized to this type of stuff, it can only have negative consequences down the line, either for them or in their actions.
I suppose it's chicken and egg. I mean, the fact that somebody decides to share something like that means they probably have already experienced a level of desensitization to this type of content. If somebody is sharing this type of content online and watching this type of content online, it means the algorithms are going to push that type of content towards them. And unless you're very savvy and try to beat the algorithms, then that's the type of content you'll be watching all of the time.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, as we know, and we bring this up on this program from time to time, obviously, sometimes instances, even when they're not videoed, you know, that we describe them as non-life-threatening injuries. That seems to be the industry norm, but that doesn't tell the full story. They can be life-changing injuries. But even when those injuries, if they fully heal, a lot of people, if not all people, it's the emotional scarring. And I suppose for this person, as they work through this, if they are aware that others are watching what happened to them, that's going to, you would have to imagine that's going to, it's going to complicate their process of recovering physically and mentally.
Well, without commenting on the individual cases, I don't know the specifics of the context in which it occurred, but for anyone who is the target of bullying, and that's about 17% of school children experience bullying in the last year, according to our research here at DCU. And that would include online and offline. And one of the key factors in the damage that and the negative impact that bullying can have is that exposure and that humiliation to an audience. In the old days, it was just those in the classroom or the schoolyard and so on. And now today it's amplified beyond that out into the millions. So, of course, there will be a negative impact on that. We also know, though, that when bullying is reported to a trusted adult and it's dealt with swiftly, that the negative impact is lessened and can be resolved in a matter of days and weeks, according to what the children and young people are telling us in research.
I think, I hate to generalise, but I'm going to do it for the function of the question. Generally speaking, we don't always talk about bullying as a society. Then the curtain's pulled back with an issue like this, and there's absolute outrage. And then the curtain falls again, and on we go. How do we try and convert some of that outrage into a meaningful conversation or action or a change of values or our societal opinions to try and make sure this doesn't happen again, or that someone doesn't feel it's okay to video this and post it online because they really see how that is wrong? That requires a all of society change of mindset, I think.
Absolutely. I think there are different levels of response to this. There's a role for parents, a role for schools, social media companies, policymakers, what we call a whole education or a whole society response. And the more work we can do with young people and with ourselves as adults before an incident like this occurs, then the less likely it will be to occur. So education around empathy and self-efficacy, you know, having the, you know, I am sure there were, in an incident like that, there are lots of onlookers who just feel helpless and don't know what to do. So one of the things we do, for example, in DCU, we run a program called Fuse that is delivered to schools all over the country, and it focuses on increasing the confidence in young people in how to recognize, respond and report to bullying. And so that kind of preventative work is really important, but it involves all partners in society working together on that. We need regulation, we need takedown, we need education, and we need parents having very gentle, open and honest conversations with their own children.
Yeah, but my concern is that, and I'm not talking about this individual case because I, like you, don't know the background to it, the narrative, the conversation amongst fully grown adults, I feel now the way the discourse is setting the stage to green light some of these instances in bullying that might be motivated by someone being of a different race or a different sexuality or a different gender. Now, I don't know how we push back against that, because I think everything's changing at the moment and it's a much bigger thing to sort out than this conversation. But I just hope adults, who often seem to be very concerned about the welfare of young people, are cautious in their language and realise that they could actually be sowing the seeds, as I say, to green light some of this activity.
Absolutely. We know from research that the people who are most likely to be targets of bullying behaviour are people who appear to be different to the majority in some way, whether it's ethnicity, skin colour, their sexuality or perceived sexuality, and so on. And those people are more vulnerable because of the way that the majority of people view them and talk about them. So we need to really and there's a silly joke or a comment at home can be the thin end of the wedge in terms of dehumanizing and objectifying these people, so that it's easier to treat them badly. Human beings are full of empathy, and we treat other human beings really well because we feel for them. So in order to be able to treat somebody like this, to bully them or to act towards them aggressively or in an uncaring way, we need to totally objectify that person and dehumanize them. And then we don't have to worry about how they feel. So the way that we talk about people who are different, the jokes we crack, all of that needs to be checked. Us as adults, we need to look at the role models.
And I don't think that's wokeness. I think that's just literally consideration for your fellow person, and treat others like you would treat, want to be treated yourself, or treat others' children as like you'd like. I mean, I don't think it's anything to do with wokeness, and people might go, oh, here we go. I don't think it's anything to do with that. It's just common manners and politeness and care for a fellow person that you might not agree with them or disagree, but you don't target them. or don't sort of sow atmosphere in a house that would allow that to happen. Professor, thank you so much for your time. I do appreciate it. Take care of yourself. That's Professor James O'Higgins Norman, who's UNESCO Chair on Bullying and Cyberbullying and is Director of DCU Anti-Bullying Centre.